Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 11th of May. We will continue listening to Master Tenjin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapow, and please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program. I hope those of you who were with us last time have had a great week, and both you and newcomers will continue to get something out of our discussions. We just started examining the text called Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun by the Tibetan master Namkar Pal. It's one of the popular mind training texts in Tibetan Buddhism. One could say that mind transformation is crucial in Buddhism, for if we are not able to weaken and eventually eliminate our negative attitudes and strengthen the positive, how can we possibly better ourselves, never mind attain enlightenment? In a commentary on the 8 points of mind training, or what he would call attitude training, His Holiness the Dalai Lama poses the question, can we really change our attitude? And answers, my answer, on the basis of my little experience, is without hesitation, yes. This is quite clear to me. The thing that we call mind is quite peculiar. Sometimes it's very stubborn and very difficult to change. But with continuous effort and with conviction based on reason, our minds are sometimes quite honest. When we really feel that there's some need to change, then our minds can change. Wishing and praying alone will not transform your mind, but with conviction and reason based ultimately on your own experience, you can transform your mind. Time is quite an important factor here, and with time, our mental attitudes can certainly change. Some research into neuroplasticity seems to confirm this. In a 2007 article titled How Thinking Can Change the Brain in the Wall Street Journal, Sharon Bagley started with a question His Holiness asked a neurosurgeon in 2004 when he was meeting with scientists in the Mind and Life series. She writes, the Dalai Lama, who had watched a brain operation during a visit to an American medical school over a decade earlier, asked the surgeons a startling question. Can the mind shape brain matter? Over the years, he said, neuroscientists had explained to him that mental experiences reflect chemical and electrical changes in the brain. When electrical impulses zip through our visual cortex, for instance, we see. When neurochemicals course through the limbic system, we feel. But something had always bothered him about this explanation, the Dalai Lama said. Could it work the other way round? That is, in addition to the brain giving rise to thoughts and hopes and beliefs and emotions that add up to this thing we call the mind, maybe the mind also acts back on the brain to cause physical changes in the very matter that created it. If so, then pure thought could change the brain's activity, its circuits, or even its structure. One brain surgeon hardly paused. Physical states give rise to mental states, he asserted. Downward causation from the mental to the physical is not possible. The Dalai Lama let the matter drop. This wasn't the first time a man of science had dismissed the possibility that the mind can change the brain. But I thought then, and I still think, that there is yet no scientific basis for such a categorical claim, he later explained. I am interested in the extent to which the mind itself and specific subtle thoughts may have an influence upon the brain. Now, of course, later experiments proved that His Holiness's suspicion that mind could influence the brain was correct. In How Thinking Can Change the Brain, Sharon Bagley continues, neuroscientist Helen Mayberg had not endeared herself to the pharmaceutical industry by discovering in 2002 that inert pills, placebos, work the same way on the brains of depressed people as antidepressants do. Activity in the frontal cortex, the seat of higher thought, increased. Activity in the limbic regions, which specialize in emotions, fell. She figured that cognitive behavioral therapy, in which patients learn to think about their thoughts differently, would act by the same mechanism. At the University of Toronto, Dr. Mayberg, Sindel, Siegel, and their colleagues first used brain imaging to measure activity in the brains of depressed adults. Some of these volunteers then received paroxetine, the generic name of the antidepressant Paxil, while others underwent 15 to 20 sessions of cognitive behavior therapy, learning not to catastrophize. That is, they were taught to break the habit of interpreting every little setback as a calamity, as when they conclude from a lousy date that no one will ever love them. All the patients' depression lifted, regardless of whether their brain were infused with a powerful drug or with a different way of thinking. Yet the only drugs that the cognitive therapy group received were their own thoughts. The scientists scanned their patients' brains again, expecting that the changes would be the same, no matter which treatment they received, as Dr. Mayberg had found in her placebo study. But no. We were totally dead wrong, she says. Cognitive behavior therapy muted overactivity in the frontal cortex, the seat of reasoning, logic, analysis, and higher thought. The antidepressant raised activity there. Cognitive behavior therapy raised activity in the limbic system, the brain's emotional center. The drug lowered activity there. With cognitive therapy, says Dr. Mayberg, the brain is rewired to adopt different thinking circuits. Voila, neuroplasticity. But the article goes on to show that attention and sustained effort will make enduring difference to the mind and the brain. Sharon Bagley writes, such discoveries of how the mind can change the brain have a spooky quality that makes you want to cue the Twilight Zone theme, but they rest on a solid foundation of animal studies. Attention, for instance, seems like one of those ephemeral things that comes and goes in the mind but has no real physical presence. Yet attention can alter the layout of the brain as powerfully as a sculptor's knife can alter a slab of stone. That was shown dramatically in an experiment with monkeys in 1993. Scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, rigged up a device that tapped monkeys' fingers 100 minutes a day, every day. As this bizarre dance was playing on their fingers, the monkeys heard sounds through headphones. Some of the monkeys were taught, ignore the sounds and pay attention to what you feel on your fingers, because when you tell us it changes, we'll reward you with a sip of juice. Other monkeys were taught, pay attention to the sound, and if you indicate when it changes, you'll get juice. After 6 weeks, the scientists compared the monkeys' brains. Usually, when a spot on the skin receives unusual amounts of stimulation, the amount of cortex that processes touch expands. That was what the scientists found in the monkeys that paid attention to the taps. The somatosensory region that processes information from the fingers doubled or tripled. But when the monkeys paid attention to the sounds, there was no such expansion. Instead, the region of the auditory cortex that processes the frequency they heard increased. Through attention, USCF Michael Mirzenich and a colleague wrote, we choose and sculpt how our ever-changing minds will work. We choose who we will be the next moment in a very real sense, and these choices are left embossed in physical form on our material selves. The discovery that neuroplasticity cannot occur without attention has important implications. If a skill becomes so routine you can do it on autopilot, practicing it will no longer change the brain. And if you take up mental exercises to keep your brain young, they will not be as effective if you become able to do them without paying much attention. Now, this bears out what the Buddhist teachings say about being mindful with everything that we do. In fact, if we are truly mindful, no moment is the same as any other. So nothing is experienced as rote, even though the mind can perform automatically. Also, it is, of course, now old news that long-term meditators who have undergone neuroimaging show remarkable brain changes. But in the argument for mind training, it is good to recall that sustained and concentrated effort will result in the changes that the teachings point to. In other words, we can make a big difference in our lives if we put concentrated and consistent effort into mind training. Sharon Bagley continues, "Since the 1990s, the Dalai Lama has been lending monks and lamas to neuroscientists for studies of how meditation alters activity in the brain. The idea was not to document brain changes during meditation, but to see whether such mental training produces enduring changes in the brain. All the Buddhist adepts, experienced meditators, who lent their brains to science had practiced meditation for at least 10,000 hours. One by one, they made their way to the basement lab of Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He and his colleagues wired them up like latter-day Medusas, a tangle of wires snaking from their scalps to the electroencephalograph that would record their brain waves. Now, just before this experiment, 10 volunteers who were not long-term meditators went through a crash course in meditation, focusing on unlimited love and compassion to all beings. The results from the electroencephalographs were compared with those of 8 Buddhist monks who'd done those many hours of meditation. Sharon Bagley reports, "As the volunteers began meditating, one kind of brainwave grew exceptionally strong, gamma waves. These, scientists believe, are a signature of neuronal activity that knits together far-flung circuits, consciousness in a sense. Gamma waves appear when the brain brings together different features of an object, such as look, feel, sound, and other attributes that lead the brain to its aha moment of, yep, that's an armadillo." Some of the novices showed a slight but significant increase in the gamma signal, Prof. Davidson explained to the Dalai Lama. "But at the moment the monk switched on compassion meditation, the gamma signal began rising and kept rising. On its own, that is hardly astonishing. Everything the mind does has a physical correlate, so the gamma waves, much more intense than in the novice meditators, might just have been a mark of compassion meditation. Except for one thing. In between meditations, the gamma signal in the monks never died down. Even when they were not meditating, their brains were different from the novices' brains, marked by waves associated with perception, problem-solving, and consciousness. Moreover, the more hours of meditation training a monk had, the stronger and more enduring the gamma signal. It was something Professor Davidson had been seeking since he trekked into the hills above Dharamsala to study lamas and monks. Evidence that mind training can create an enduring brain tray. Professor Davidson then used MRI imaging to detect which regions of the monks' and novices' brains became active during compassion meditation. The brains of all the subjects showed activity in regions that monitor one's emotions, plan movements, and generate positive feelings such as happiness. Regions that keep track of what is self and what is other became quieter, as if during compassion meditation the subjects opened their minds and hearts to others. More interesting were the differences between the monks and the novices. The monks had much greater activation in brain regions called the right insula and caudate, a network that underlies empathy and maternal love. They also had stronger connections from the frontal regions to the emotion regions, which is the pathway by which higher thought can control emotions. In each case, monks with the most hours of meditation showed the most dramatic brain changes. That was a strong hint that mental training makes it easier for the brain to turn on circuits that underlie compassion and empathy. This positive state is a skill that can be trained, Professor Davidson says. Our findings clearly indicate that meditation can change the function of the brain in an enduring way. It is significant that the more hours the monks spent in meditation and mind training, the stronger the change in their brains. Many times, people have come to teachings, been convinced of the methods for transforming the mind, and gone away to practice. Then, a short while later, they've returned, complaining that their minds don't change, but stubbornly return to the same old patterns. Well, of course. Since long before our birth, and well into this life, we've been steering our mind in certain well-defined directions. And now we expect all that conditioning to change in a week or two's relatively feeble practice. It's just not going to happen. To really change the mind, we need sustained practice over a long time. From a Buddhist point of view, the most fundamental changes may take lifetimes of practice. But that does not mean that we cannot start and make good progress in this life. So that is what the mind training teachings are all about and why they are important in our lives. Now, the text we are following is quite comprehensive. It is not only focused on love and compassion like Davison's experiment, but it does lead to states of greater perception, problem-solving, and consciousness, as Bagley mentions in the article. So now let's return to Nam Kha Pel and mind training like the rays of the sun. We left off last time discussing the preliminary practices and had talked about taking refuge, offering a mandala, and were touching on the seven-limb practice. This practice is aimed at the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Gurus and starts off with prostrating to show respect and throw our lives in a safe direction, as Dr. Alex Berzin puts it, making vast offerings, confessing or admitting and regretting our faults, and rejoicing in the virtue of ourselves and others, especially the great beings. At the end of the last session, we got up to the fifth limb, which is requesting the teachers to actually teach. The final two limbs are beseeching teachers to stay with us for a long time, and finally, dedication. So those are the seven limbs: prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting to teach, beseeching not to go, and dedication. Let's just recall our last quote of the day from last week, from Wanchen Rinpoche, talking about requesting the teachings in his book, Buddhist Fasting Practice, The Nyungne Method of Thousand Arm Chenrezig. He said, "In today's world, there are many examples of people looking for a true spiritual teaching and path, and although they may desperately want to find a pure teaching and pure path, many are unable to find them. Some find a wrong teaching and wrong path, and others who may find Buddha Dharma might still not be able to find the right teacher and the right teaching. Because of that, they may become upset and turn away from the Dharma altogether, creating the same kind of karma again that was the cause for their being lost in the first place. Then one never knows for how many lifetimes they may get caught in a vicious cycle like this. If done properly, requesting the Dharma teaching will help one to overcome this unfortunate situation once and for all. A true teacher and true teaching are absolute necessities. Without them, we have no way of learning anything. Every little bit of knowledge that anybody has comes from a teacher. Therefore, it is absolutely necessary to request that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas teach the three vehicles so that we can overcome pain and suffering, and confusion and illusion, and experience the wisdom mind of the Buddhas." He points to two more important reasons for requesting the teachings. One is to ask those nearly at the state of Buddhahood to quickly reach the final stage so that they can most effectively teach. The other is directed at Buddhas who might be ready and able to teach but find their audience, that is, sentient beings like us, too busy indulging in their negativities to be receptive. These Buddhas will then stay silently in peace. I bet secondary school teachers faced by unruly teenagers wish they had this option open to them. You will know that after the Prince Siddhartha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya, he wondered whether he should teach or not. He thought that people would not be able to comprehend what he had to tell them. Eventually, after he had been implored by the gods, he decided to go ahead and teach anyway. So before any newly enlightened Buddhas find themselves in that type of quandary, we request them to teach. Rinpoche says that by doing this, we create dependent arising circumstances to avoid the kind of situation where the Buddhas are doubtful about commencing to teach. And he says, in any case, the positive karma we create by requesting can even benefit those beings who are too intent on other things, too busy with their earthly excitements to pay much attention. The next part of the seven-limb practice is asking the teachers to stay. Dr. Alex Berzin says, the sixth limb is beseeching the teachers not to enter parinirvana, which means not to go away. What does this mean on a practical level? It is saying to the Buddhas and teachers, I'm serious, don't go away. Teach me all the way up to my enlightenment. I want to go the full path, don't leave in the middle. That is the main thing. We're rarely going to do it, no matter how long it takes, no matter how many lifetimes it takes. Wangchen Rinpoche gives a more traditional and extensive view when he writes, beseeching the Buddhas not to pass into nirvana is the remedy for wrong view. From the point of view of true Dharma, those who hand on to the world with eternalistic or nihilistic views have wrong views. While there are many erroneous spiritual and philosophical views, they're all included in eternalism and nihilism. One of the main reasons that sentient beings have wrong views is their inability in the past to develop faith and devotion to enlightened causes. When we beseech the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to remain with us in samsara, everyone is afforded the opportunity to eventually develop the right view. Beseeching sublime ones to dispel wrong views is for our own benefit as well as the benefit of others. Even though we are already on the path, we still have residual wrong view karma. When true enlightened teachers remain with us, slowly, slowly their blessings will transform us and our view will mature. Eventually, it will become perfect. It is understood that throughout the universe, many Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have come to the world to benefit others and are about to pass into nirvana. We are asking them to remain in the world until samsara is emptied. Rinpoche then talks about the extensive long life ceremonies the Tibetans organize for their highly realized teachers. Ceremonies that can go on for up to 7 days with very elaborate prayers and offerings, sometimes involving religious dances. There is enormous benefit in beseeching the sublime ones to remain, he says, relative as well as ultimate benefit. Relatively, dependent arising causes and conditions are established so that our own obstacles to longevity will be dispelled and we can enjoy long life and freedom from sickness. And good karma is created, enabling us to receive Dharma teachings and to spend a long time together with great masters. The ultimate benefit is having the opportunity to intermingle our minds with the wisdom minds of the Buddhas. So that's the sixth limb, requesting the great beings to remain and not go into parinirvana. The final and seventh limb is dedication of merit. Once again, Dr. Berzin gives a short explanation of this, while Wangchen Rinpoche goes more in depth. Dr. Berzin says, the final step is the dedication. That is the most important step of all. We dedicate whatever positive force and deep awareness we have built up from this practice for us and for everyone to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all. Short and sweet. Wangchen Rinpoche, on the other hand, starts off with, dedication of merit is the remedy for doubts and skepticism in the sense that the obscuration of disbelief is purified when one dedicates without hesitation. In other words, mind's habit of obfuscating is eliminated. Obfuscating means making obscure or unclear or unintelligible. Wangchen Rinpoche continues, dedication is one of the very important spiritual practices. Without proper dedication, the result of any virtuous deed will come to an end once the fruit is enjoyed. On the other hand, if you do a proper dedication, you will be able to enjoy its result life after life, and the deed will be inexhaustible until you attain enlightenment. Without dedication, there is the danger of the virtuous deed being destroyed by a subsequent powerful aggressive deed. And if you brag about your good deed without dedication, there's a danger of the virtue being robbed altogether. In the case of virtuous deeds accumulated through offerings, the virtue will be diminished if, out of greed, you later regret these offerings. However, when one dedicates the merit for one's deeds, the power of anger, boasting, and greed cannot destroy it. It has been said in the scripture that non-dedicated virtue will never increase, whereas dedicated virtue will double every single day. In this way, we have the opportunity to make our little virtue into truly great virtue. Knowing what constitutes a proper dedication is important. A correct dedication must be free from the three concepts of subject, object, and action, the meritorious deed. Conceptually bound dedication is considered venomous dedication because it's not really a true dedication. Therefore, its effects can only be within the samsaric realm. It cannot become a truly enlightened cause. And this is the hard part, because no ordinary being can do it. But there's a trick, and that is to request all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to witness your wish to make a pure dedication free from the three concepts. Then you pray, just as the Buddhas of the past, present, and future have dedicated merit, similarly I wish to follow in their footsteps and dedicate the merit for the benefit of all beings. So what does free from the concepts of subject, object, and action mean? Here Rinpoche is referring to the ultimate nature of the subject. That is the person making the dedication, the object, which is the person or event the dedication is made for, and the actual action of making the offering. Ultimately, none of these exist independently or inherently. Now let's take a rather rough example. Say you dedicate the result of a positive action to the welfare of your friend. Now if I asked you to define the person making the dedication, what would you say? Would you claim that your body is the person? If so, I ask you, is there a body separate from the body parts? When we take the body apart, laying all the parts alongside each other, will we find anything that is the actual body not dependent on the parts? No. The body is just a collection of parts in a certain order, plus all the causes and conditions that brought those parts into that sequence and are keeping them operating as they do. We cannot find anything that is a single body independent of parts, causes, and conditions. So how can this collection be the you that appears to be independent and inherent? Especially as each part is itself a collection of parts, causes, and conditions. And each of those are a collection of parts, causes, and conditions. And we can regress like this to almost nothingness. The mind can be viewed in the same way. We cannot actually find an independent body or mind. So we cannot find an independent you that does not depend on body and mind and all the causes and conditions that built and maintain the body and mind collection. Even though the mind grasps at a real I that seems to exist inherently and independently. Similarly, we can't find a real friend or real action when we analyze each in the same way. All the three, the subject of the dedication, the object, and the dedication itself, are empty of inherent independent existence, completely empty. And that is what is meant by free from the concepts of subject, object, and action. Free from having the concepts of subject, object, and action having independent inherent existence. In one sutra, the Sutra of the Vajrapika on dedication, five steps of dedication are explained. The first one is to summon all the merit you've created by yourself, all sentient beings and the noble beings, like all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and so on, and dedicate this virtue as a cloud of offerings to all the Buddhas. And the second, dedicate all the virtue to the flourishing of the Buddha's teachings in this world. And the third point is to dedicate to the longevity and expanded activity of the upholders of the teachings. And the fourth one is to dedicate to the happiness and prosperity of all the beings in the world. The final and fifth one is to dedicate to the achievement of perfect enlightenment for all beings. Of course, you can also dedicate all that virtue to a main object of dedication, somebody who's benefited you, or to somebody that's passed on. Now, I hope you've grasped some of what we've tried to explain here, as we're going to have to leave it here for the day. Time is once again up, so please dedicate the program, as we've discussed, to gain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, realizing that you, the subject, sentient beings, the object, and the action of dedication are all empty of inherent independent existence. Thanks for being with us today, and I look forward to being with you again in a week's time. Until then, have a wonderful week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.